The New Yorker Radio Hour Fiction is supported by the official Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On the official Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Tan Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is the New Yorker Fiction Podcast from The New Yorker Magazine. I'm Deborah Treisman, fiction editor at The New Yorker. Each month, we invite a writer to choose a story from the magazine's archives to read and discuss. This month, we're going to hear Likes by Sarah Swanyen Bynum, which appeared in The New Yorker in October of 2017.
Even to his own ears, he sounded sorry for himself, but his daughter, good for her, was not thinking about him or his feelings. She stared at the elevator doors. "You're making me feel like I talk too much," she whispered furiously, deep in her own embarrassment.
The story was chosen by David Bosmoskis, who is the author of two novels and two story collections, Natasha and Other Stories, which won the Commonwealth Writers Prize for Best First Book, and Immigrant City, which was a finalist for the Giller Prize in 2019. Hi, David.
Hi, Deborah.
Welcome back to the show.
Thank you. Nice to be back.
When you were deciding what to read today, you hesitated between two stories by Sarah Swanyen Bynum. Can you tell me what made you choose Likes in the end, and also what just makes you a fan of her work in general?
I guess what made me choose it was kind of a sort of a superficial reason, because they're both wonderful stories, and she's excellent at writing children, and both of those stories feature kids in one way or another. And I just love also how funny she can be. There's this wonderful sort of wry humor, or sometimes, you know, more than wry. These stories can be very, very funny, which I always enjoy.
Yeah. What do you think she does with the lives of children that is unusual?
Well, it's a good question. I don't know if it's unusual, but she's very good at it.
It's hard to do, right?
It's very hard to do. I can't think of a thing in writing that is easy to do, but but it's hard. I think something as simple as like making them feel like real people, not condescending, and also giving them kind of a wildness. In the other story, the one that we're not talking about, The Earl King, there's a remarkable, vivid, dark fantasy world to the child that's kind of menacing and otherworldly. Sarah just does such a remarkable job making it feel real. And here it's intimating the unspoken, you know, the things that children don't tell you. And she has a way of creating these spaces in her stories, because they're stories of not just children with children, but they're almost always stories of parents and children. And so it's like what the parent wants to know and can't know. And that becomes a feature of it. And that's definitely a big part of Likes.
Right. So the story is more or less told from the point of view of a father, the father of a sixth grader. And it involves her Instagram feed, among other things. And the story came out almost 7 years ago. But I feel like for parents of tween or teenage girls, which both of us are, it still feels very contemporary.
Yeah. I mean, that's part of the superficial reason for choosing it. The fact that it feels very contemporary from that respect, which is surprising because of how fast we feel like technology moves. And it feels really like nothing has changed in that respect. And the other respect is the other side of this story, because it's two things that happen at once, like the father's following this Instagram feed, but it's a particular moment in time, which is the 2016 election. And so these things get fused together in an interesting way. They're related because of, you know, like we'll talk about it after, I suppose, but it's like, what is it about that election, and what is it about the father's inability to understand his daughter that are these sort of common elements?
Right. We're facing a similar election. So maybe that's what makes it feel even more timely.
Well, that's it. Yeah. That's sort of the superficial thing that in a way I'm kind of embarrassed to say that that's part of the reason for choosing it. But it is remarkable to come across a story 8 years later, practically, and see that we're kind of in the same place.
Well, we will talk some more after the story. And now here's David Bismoskis reading Likes by Sarah Swenyan Bynum.
Likes. The dad scrolled through his daughter's Instagram account, looking for clues. The most recent post was a photograph of an ice cream cone, extravagantly large, held up against a white wall by a disembodied hand. Peppermint stick or strawberry. The mound was starting to melt, a trickle of it inching down the cone and drawing dangerously close to the thumb, his daughter's. The next photo was a close-up of a shop window. Inside the window glowed a pink neon sign spelling out the word warm in lowercase letters. The glowing word took up most of the frame. It was impossible to tell what sort of store it was. Another close-up, an eraser-colored rose, its petals halfway unfurled. A panorama, the sky at sunset. A shot of her dog, Bob, curled up like a cinnamon bun on the pleated, peachy expanse of her bed. And then an earlobe. Was that what it was? Soft, rounded, partly in shadow. He closed his eyes and put down the phone. His daughter was nearly 12, and difficult to talk to. Normally, she rode the bus home from school, but now that she had to do physical therapy twice a week, he had been picking her up and taking her to the appointments. He felt responsible. These problems with her joints, runner's knee, Achilles tendonitis, were undoubtedly a handicap she'd inherited from his gouty side of the family. In ballet class, she could no longer do grand pliés or go up to relevé. In the middle of the night, she would wake up in pain. He kept a tin of Tiger Balm on her nightstand so that she could find it easily in the dark. The physical therapist was a young woman dressed as an older one in iron slacks and support shoes. She had a secretive smile and a stiff demeanor. The dad didn't always feel comfortable asking her questions, but his daughter seemed to like her. "Hi, Ivy," the therapist would murmur as they entered the office, her little smile widening, and the two of them would disappear into the equipment. From the waiting room, the dad could hear the whir of the stationary bicycle and the sound of their voices, his silent companion from the car suddenly talkative. It made a kind of music, the wheel spinning and her talking. Correction. His daughter wasn't entirely silent in the car. She sang along to songs on the radio, songs patchy with blanked-out words that she made a point of mouthing but didn't say aloud. A billboard might prompt her to ask a question like, "Why is she drinking out of a paper bag?" Sometimes, gazing at her phone, she would let out a low, triumphant hiss. Yes! She had gotten every answer right on the Kylie Jenner quiz. Received 74 likes on her ice cream photo. Set a new personal record on her Snapchat streak with Talia. Other days, her phone lay inert in her lap. Only last week, she had asked, eyes brimming and fixed on the dashboard, "Dad, can I be homeschooled?" Undone, he'd answered, "Sure." After physical therapy in the elevator heading down to the parking lot, he gave her a squeeze and said, "You're quite the conversationalist in there." His daughter looked at him with alarm. Of course it hadn't come out the way he'd wanted it to. "I'm glad," he tried again, "that there's an adult you enjoy talking to," which was true, although it sounded as if he meant the opposite. Even to his own ears, he sounded sorry for himself, but his daughter, good for her, was not thinking about him or his feelings. She stared at the elevator doors. "You're making me feel like I talk too much," she whispered furiously, deep in her own embarrassment. New Instagram post. A peeled-off pair of ballet tights splayed on the white tiles of a bathroom floor. Some days his daughter's quietness in the car felt blank and mysterious, but some days it felt excruciatingly full, like an inflamed internal organ about to burst. On one such afternoon, the dad said carefully, "I'm not going to look at you. I'm not going to say anything. I'm just going to keep my eyes on the road. I'm going to keep driving, and when you're ready, you say whatever you want." After a moment of silence, she said, "I'm considering it." And then, "Can I curse?" He nodded. She asked, "You won't make any noises or have any expressions at all on your face. He nodded again. They drove for several more minutes. The effort was killing him. Also the dread. He wasn't sure if he had the capacity to receive whatever feeling it was that she was full of. When they were only 3 blocks from the therapist's office, she said to the windshield, "I have no friends." As he eased into the parking lot, she said, "And don't tell me you were just at Annie's house last Friday. I know that's what you're going to say. But you can't make me feel better. People only hang out with me because there's nobody else around. I'm not their friend." She opened the car door slowly. "I'm their second choice." She heaved her backpack off the floor while he stayed behind the wheel, noticing his breath and absorbing the punch in various parts of his body. Why hadn't she cursed? New post. A hamburger with lettuce and Thousand Island dressing, cut in half, cooked medium rare. The physical therapist recommended a series of exercises to do at home. Some, like the calf raises, were straightforward. But others had names such as clam. Studying the printout with its unhelpful black and white drawings, the dad asked, "You understand what all of this means? Fire hydrant, dipping bird, short bridge, clock." His daughter didn't glance up from her phone. "Uh-huh." He stuck the paper to the refrigerator with a magnet. It looked somewhat quaint there. All her handouts from school were now distributed digitally for environmental reasons. "You know you're supposed to be doing these every night." No answer. Marooned on one side of the island, he wondered, not for the first time, if open concept was such a great thing after all. Was she in the kitchen, talking with him, or was she in the family room, on the sofa, with her phone? Unclear. Without untying the laces, she scraped off her sneakers, toe to heel, 2 consecutive thunks. "Your progress depends on it. You know that, right?" Elegantly, she lifted her long legs up and out of sight. "Ivy?" She sank beneath the horizon of the sofa. "Hello?" Guess what? Her only homework was to watch TV. This was what his daughter announced when he picked her up from ballet class. In a series of texts, he and his wife agreed that they would order ramen and watch the presidential debate as a family. And though it took them a while to get started, the restaurant had sent only 1 spicy instead of 2, and when they sat down on the sofa, Bob kept jumping into their laps and had to be crated. Once they finally organized themselves, with their drinks and their bowls and their napkins and their chopsticks, it felt warm and momentous being there together in front of the television. Dorothy muttered encouragement at the moderator. "Keep at him," she said, bent over her noodles. "Keep the pressure on." As long as Dorothy was leaning forward, he could now and then steal a sideways glance at his daughter. She appeared to be paying attention, her eyes slightly widened, and her bowl sitting neglected on the coffee table. Then, suddenly, she leaped off the sofa and ran upstairs. "You all right?" he called. "Ivy?" "It's making me uncomfortable," she yelled from the top of the staircase. He could picture her standing there, 1 foot raised, ready to flee. "Tell me when this part is over, okay?" He wanted to share a commiserating look with Dorothy, but she was still watching the screen, sawing her little pendant back and forth on its chain. "So much for current events," he said. His daughter had a pretty collection of pens and pencils, a tiny roll of tape, a pink pocket stapler, and a packet of candy-colored paper clips. All these items lived inside a sleek gold pouch with a zipper and were brought out into the open when she was doing her homework at the kitchen table. Her tapered fingers danced over them in search of the right highlighter. Her fingernails sparkled, her school supplies sparkled. She had affixed very small puffy stickers in specific places to her notebooks and binders. Watching her at work, he realized with pride that his daughter would have been one of those girls who intimidated him when he was that age. When he was that age, a slight prickling, like sensation restoring itself to a numb hand, was his old self considering a return? To his surprise, he had trouble recalling his thoughts and emotions from 6th grade. Surprising because he remembered the fact of having felt things, he was the point at which his parents took to calling him Heathcliff. There were a few standouts, to be sure. The memory of being lifted into the air and carried on a gurney after he'd badly sprained his ankle on the basketball court, and noticing how far away the ceiling of the gym appeared and the menacing pattern of the rafters. But in terms of day-to-day 12-year-old feelings, he had, strangely, lost access. And the access needed to be only temporary. All he wanted was a point of comparison. Was what she was going through normal? In the afternoons, he held his breath, never knowing which girl was going to climb into the passenger seat. The happy one, braces flashing, asking if they could make a really quick stop at Baskin-Robbins, or the other one, the one in pain. Had he ever felt that way, too? If only he could remember. All that came to him were the first and last names, in no particular order, of every kid in his homeroom. Stephen Burke, Tracy Mason, Derek Wong, Billy Flanagan, Don Littlejohn, Josh Dukovsky, Luke Mandel, Rafi Moncho, Danielle Blood. And sometimes, along with the names, the faces would materialize, like mugshots. New post. A pair of lips, shining wetly. "Try not to internalize," Dorothy whispered to him, taking his hand as they waited in the dank hallway outside the Nutcracker auditions. "Practice wearing a neutral expression." They stood in silence for a while, trying to hear what was going on behind the closed doors. When their daughter finally exited, looking a little dazed, they gently shepherded her to the car. Did she want lunch? Starbucks? "If it's okay, I think I'd just like to go home and watch YouTube," she said quietly. From the depths of the sofa, a now familiar voice bubbled. "Hi guys, I'm back, and I'm so excited because today I'm going to be talking about room decor. And as you guys know, I love being creative when it comes to doing DIY decor. But today is extra special because I'm going to be showing you my mini home goods haul. I got so many amazing things, but I think the thing that I love the most is this incredibly fluffy pillow. As you can see, it's huge, and I'm pretty sure it's real sheepskin. Yeah, it says here 100% wool from New Zealand, but don't worry, no sheep were killed or anything. I don't think so, right? It'll just grow back. But the best part is how good it goes with these other decorative pillows I got at Home Goods. That place is so amazing. Their selection is always changing. I went in thinking I needed picture frames and a dog bed, but then I turned down this one aisle and I saw the pillows and I went crazy. By nightfall, his daughter seemed to have revived. She practiced her jazz turns on the slick floor of the kitchen. She winked and dimpled at her reflection in the sliding doors, as if for an audience stretching into the darkened backyard. The dad, rinsing dishes in the sink, had to keep dodging her left foot, which she kicked, without warning, high into the air. She always kicked on that side. It was naturally the more flexible of the two. To the dad, it would have made more sense to practice kicking on the less stretchy side. "I am the best," she sang tunelessly. "The best, the best, the best. You can't beat me, no you can't. So don't even try, because I'm the best." The song sounded as if it had been made up on the spot. Later that week, the physical therapist came into the waiting room while his daughter was still whirring away on the bicycle. For a moment, he thought, she was there to grab a magazine. But then she perched on the chair beside him and started speaking. "I'm wondering," she said, wearing her small, formal smile, "if Ivy has been keeping up with her exercises at home." His chest began to tingle, the Ivy vice squeezing. She wasn't improving. She wasn't going to get a decent part in the Nutcracker. She'd have to spend a second year in the Angel Corps, shuffling across the stage in the snowflake scene while holding a battery-operated candle from Home Depot. He felt totally defeated. "I think she has," he said. "I've been telling her to." Then he admitted, "but I really don't know." To his shame, he heard himself adding, somewhat sulkily, "maybe you should ask her." Another not-great day at school. His daughter buried her chin and mouth into the folds of her scarf and stared unseeing at the road, not bothering to change the radio station. Election coverage continued unchecked in the background. Beyond the windshield, a vapor trail bisected the blue sky. Closer to the ground, block after block of residential development streamed past. As they merged onto the highway, she asked, "Do you think I cry too much?" He sat with the question for a handful of seconds, and then inquired, evenly, "Who told you that?" When she didn't answer, he asked, a little less evenly, "Who said that bullshit to you?" Also, when did it become a crime to feel things? She retreated deeper into her scarf. "Oh God, Dad, forget I asked. It doesn't matter." And he glanced down at the insulated cup resting in the holder between them. That fucking coffee. He'd been suckered by the promised ease of drive-through and ended up arriving 10 minutes late for pickup. Only 10 minutes. Not even a quarter of an hour, but long enough for someone to have said something awful to her. If that indeed was what had happened. Who knew what really went on in the cluster of low-slung buildings that she disappeared into and emerged from every day? He had the urge to carry her far away from them, as far as possible. The value of peer interaction was definitely overstated. He could fill the tank, surprise Dorothy at work, load the trunk with non-perishable groceries and supplies, and then it'd be just the three of them, the open road. Not like free spirits exactly, more like refugees from the zombie apocalypse, but still, they'd be together. Plus Bob. He'd almost forgotten the dog. New post. A cupcake, frosted to look like the face of a cute pig. In late October, unexpectedly, a stretch of sunshine. First off, she'd been cast as a dragon dancer in the Chinese tea scene, and even though only the lower half of her would be visible, she was coming home from the rehearsals in high spirits, which she attributed to teamwork, telling him, you see, it is like playing a sport. And then, in the space of a few days, an evite to a disco-themed murder mystery party. An afternoon working with her partner on a social studies project that turned into a movie night and a sleepover. A plan to go with three girls from her Girl Scout troop to the outlet mall. The dad stood on the front walkway and watched her slide into the back seat of the troop mother's minivan. As it pulled away from the curb, he waved to the shadowy parent behind the wheel. Their neighbor, Marcia, happened to be dragging in her trash cans. He waved at her, too. I can't believe how big she's getting, Marcia called. Tell me about it, he said. Always running off somewhere. I can't keep up. He knew he sounded like an ass, but he couldn't help it. He floated up the walkway and in through the front door, and finding Dorothy upstairs shaking out the bed covers, he hugged her from behind and made her topple over. On Tuesday, the physical therapist greeted them as usual. Hi, Ivy, she said through her little smile, as if he were merely the hulking, nameless attendant who traveled alongside the patient. But today it didn't bother him, because right away he saw that she had done her duty and voted. He pointed to the oblong sticker on the breast pocket of her gray, grown-up-looking blouse, and then pointed to the same sticker attached to his own chest. Earlier, he had debated whether he should wait until after school and take his daughter with him. It'd be something that she could tell her daughter about, had been his thinking. But then he remembered that she had therapy, and during his lunch hour went ahead, on his own, to the polling station, which was in the cavernous basement of an Armenian church. After pointing to their matching stickers, he gave the physical therapist a grin and a thumbs up. Uncharacteristically, she returned the gesture with open enthusiasm. Oh-ho! Maybe he'd stumbled upon the best way to communicate with her, through hand signals. He swelled suddenly with positive feelings for her. This competent young woman who was helping his daughter, those nice Armenian congregants who volunteered for long shifts at the polls, the sensible, civic-minded men and women who patiently waited with him, giving up their lunch hours as he had. He felt good about them. He felt good about humanity in general. Basic decency would prevail, and this exhausting, insane election season would soon be over, and by tomorrow he could commit his energies fully to planning the Thanksgiving menu and making sure that his daughter did her fire hydrants every night and got better. New post. A black square. Not a photo of a black square, but a photo of total blackness, as if the camera had misfired or the film had been accidentally exposed. The whole family had a hard time getting up the next morning. Dad felt as if he had been run over by a truck, the big, shiny pickup truck that had come swerving out of the darkness and mowed him down, and now had backed up and was waiting for him, its engine revving. His daughter crouched by his pillow and asked, as she often did, "Do I have to go to school today?" Her eyes had turned narrow from crying, then sleeping. Her nightshirt had a silvery unicorn on it. They had let her stay up to watch the results with them, and even in the dim light she looked haggard. "No," he said, placing the pillow over his head, "go back to sleep." It was what he intended to do. He had a very small window in which he could slip back into unconsciousness and then wake up in a world where the election hadn't happened. He tried the trick he'd developed after the first of several basketball injuries, the trick where he would slow his breathing and lie perfectly still, and the throbbing in his ankle would cease, and he could fool himself into believing that he was strong and well before finally relaxing into sleep. He imagined himself in his old bedroom, on his narrow bed, wearing nothing but his Celtics shorts. He repeated to himself, "Fit as a fiddle, fit as a fiddle." But he was agonizingly awake. Dorothy's body heat beside him was throwing him off. He pushed away the pillow and sighed, and was startled to see his daughter standing in the doorway, fully dressed, with her backpack on. "What are you doing?" he groaned. "Why aren't you in bed?" She took a nervous step backward. "Daddy," she said, "I thought you were joking." Life was a subject on which his daughter collected inspirational quotes. Her favorite, "Life always offers you a second chance. It's called tomorrow," served as the bio on her Instagram profile. If asked to describe herself, she invariably said either fantabulous or optimistic. Among the many items on the third draft of her Christmas list was something called a happiness planner, a daily journal designed, she explained, to create positive thinking and personal growth. Christmas was well over a month away, though nearly all the houses on the block already had their lights up. On a cold morning, the dad sank into the driver's seat, and in a fog, he backed the car down the driveway and into the street before he became aware of a painted wooden sign on top of his dashboard. It was long and thin, with a black background and italicized gold lettering. The paint had been deliberately rubbed away from the sign's edges to make it look like an heirloom that had once hung in an ancestor's homestead. Usually the sign hung on the wall above his daughter's bed, for the most part unnoticed by him. But now, looking at it closely, he saw that its syntax was slightly garbled. It read, "Life is always offered a second chance. It's called tomorrow." Not as bad as what he'd seen in some instruction manuals, but still off, and annoyingly so, considering that the words were the whole point. He flipped over the sign to confirm his suspicions about where it had been manufactured. "Proudly made in Michigan, USA," the sticker said. He didn't know why he bothered feeling surprised anymore. He tossed the sign into the back seat, face down. It struck him as darkly symbolic, as so many things did these days. Impersonal life, marching on, taking for itself all the tomorrows you had squandered. And don't get him started on Michigan. How did the unintelligible thing even end up on his dashboard? He'd have to remind Ivy to take it up to her room, or else it would remain in the back of his car for months. "Do you realize how Snapchat works?" Dorothy asked him, her face lit up in the dark by her laptop. "That it just disappears, the photos they send each other, and that they can write captions on them. Then it all goes poof, like in 5 seconds it's gone. So there's no way of knowing what they're receiving or putting out there, what images and messages they're being exposed to. There's no way to monitor any of it because it vanishes." She clicked on her trackpad. "Hey, do you know about this?" He rolled toward her and grunted, "Uh-huh." With his mouth guardian, it wasn't easy to enunciate. She reached over to the nightstand and then dropped the neoprene eye mask onto his face, saying, "I think I'm going to be up for a little while." He heaved himself back onto his more comfortable side, the side with the good shoulder, and pulled the mask down over his eyes. Everything disappeared. There was something about being suddenly swaddled in darkness that made each of her clicks seem slightly louder than the one before, as if the source of the sound were coming, very slowly, closer. The next morning, Dorothy returned from her run bearing a stack of newspapers in her arms, somewhat tentatively, like she was carrying someone else's baby. She dropped it heavily onto the island. "Since when do we subscribe to The Guardian?" she asked, "and The New York Times?" The dad looked up from his phone in confusion. He did recall making a few late-night donations to the NRDC and the Southern Poverty Law Center, but he'd forgotten all about the newspapers. "You know, there's this thing called a digital subscription," she remarked as she opened the refrigerator. He moved out of her way. "That's what I did with the Washington Post," he said, remembering now, "because they don't deliver outside the D.C. area." "In a week, this place is going to look like a hoarder's house," Dorothy predicted. "Piles of newspaper everywhere." "I just think it's important to model," the dad said, looking meaningfully in the direction of the sofa. "Model where we get our information from." He half expected his daughter's head to pop up like a groundhog's at the mention of model. Kendall Jenner? Gigi Hadid? No, not that kind of model, he heard himself saying wearily over a laugh track. Dorothy handed him a glass of juice. Stop looking so pious, she said. I agree with you. New post. A hand holding a clear plastic Starbucks cup filled with a liquid the color of Pepto-Bismol. In it floated small chunks of something red. Do you think this is full of caffeine? Dorothy asked, her screen tilted in his direction. Though they'd made a reservation, their table wasn't ready. They stood wedged into the little area by the door where umbrellas would have gone if it had been raining. Who knows what they actually put in their drinks? The door opened, the air was cold, and they squeezed closer together to let the new arrivals through. Well, she gets points for consistency, I'll give her that, Dorothy murmured, as she continued thumbing her phone. She's really thinking about her palate. Her palate? That was how he heard it, palate, like where Joan of Arc would have slept. On her Instagram, it's pink. Her palate is a mix of light pink and hot pink. He still didn't understand what she was talking about. With the occasional salmon accent thrown in, he blinked angrily. Dorothy had downloaded the app only a week ago. What about the picture of Michelle Obama, he asked. She's not pink. Her dress is, his wife smiled at him. At this point, the hostess looked up from her station and signaled for them to approach. The noise of the restaurant rose up around them, and for a moment he felt enfolded by the warm lighting and the voices and the smell of food being thoughtfully prepared, but none of it gave him any pleasure. As soon as they were seated, he ordered wine for both of them, and in a little bout of resentment told Dorothy that a pink palate struck him as depressingly cliched. Ivy was just imitating what she saw other girls doing online. Carefully styled shots of donuts and videos of dissolving bath bombs. Groupthink, he said. She kept talking about her personal style and her vibe and her aesthetic, but nothing about it was actually hers. The photo of her hand holding the pink drink from Starbucks? He'd seen practically the same image posted 100 times before. His wife reached out and touched the arm of the passing server. Can we get a new fork, please? Accidentally, he had knocked his off the table. I know you don't like it when I talk about YouTubers, but can I tell you just this one thing? What makes Ashley Janine different from a lot of other YouTubers is that she's really honest with her fans. She'll come right out and say who's sponsoring her. She doesn't try to hide it or make it seem like it's just a coincidence that she uses Simple and Clinique. She'll say, I'm so excited to be working with these brands. And also, she's grateful. She says all the time how blessed she is, because she knows it's not usual for a 23-year-old to be buying her first house and have it be so big. She's buying a house? With a pool. Wow, he said. Her own pool. She's already moved in. Tomorrow she's going to Lowe's to buy houseplants. What's Simple? He knew what Clinique was. It's a makeup remover, like cleansing facial wipes. They don't use artificial perfumes or harsh chemicals, so it won't upset your skin. She bought a house by using cleansing wipes. She has a lot of other sponsors, not just Simple. Plus, she's writing a YA novel, so she gets money from that, too. He didn't know how to continue the conversation. Accelerating, he made it through a yellow light. Dad, his daughter said, after a minute or two, when Ashley's book comes out, can I get it? He must have looked ill-disposed, or maybe he just looked ill, because then she said jovially, come on, it's reading. But could it really be called reading? Did it actually count as a book? Or was it just something amazing? Something to be so excited about, to be so grateful for. I hope you guys enjoyed it. I had so much fun doing it. And if you want me to do more things like this, make sure to give it a big thumbs up and comment down below. And don't forget to subscribe to my vlog channel, which just got, I can't believe it, 2 million subscribers, because there you can see all the behind the scenes. So yeah. Thank you for watching, and I love you guys so, so, so much. In fact, would it be going too far to call it tremendous? Something incredible, a massive story, and very complex, made by some really incredible people of such incredible talent. It'll be a big win. There's no question about it, and I can tell you why. Because number one, the enthusiasm. The enthusiasm for this, it is really tremendous. Right before the impact, he heard his daughter gasp. And in the silence afterward, he felt her chest rising and falling rapidly against his outstretched arm. New post. A bared collarbone with a seatbelt burn running diagonally across it, the welt shiny with ointment and pink. During the intermission of the Nutcracker, he was startled to see the physical therapist standing in line for the ladies' room. She was holding a potted orchid from Trader Joe's and wearing a velvet blazer. "You came," he said, a little too loudly. He glanced around to see if maybe she had brought a date. She asked him, "Is this Ivy's mom?" And he remembered to introduce Dorothy, who promptly apologized for the length and overall tedium of the production. "But I'm enjoying it," the therapist protested. She complimented the girl who danced Arabian Coffee and also the Chinese dragon dancers who had succeeded, the dad admitted, in bringing a sort of unruly street energy to the show. "Ivy was wonderful," she said, and together he and Dorothy smiled. "Like you could really tell," he said. She looked at him seriously. "I would know those legs anywhere. Overpronation of the feet. Well-developed gastrocnemius." She was third from the back. The confidence with which she said it moved him unexpectedly. He wished he could say he knew anything that well. He thought of all the time she had spent working with his daughter deep in the forest of equipment, 2 times a week for nearly 3 months. Not only a licensed professional, but an expert in her field. And here she was, on her day off. It was the therapist who was smiling now. "Don't look like that, Dave," she said. "It's not magic or anything. It's just my job." He began smiling too, to show that he, of course, understood, but judging from the expression on her face and on Dorothy's, it was very possible that his eyes were also leaking a little. The likelihood made him smile even more, that and the fact that, well, what do you know? She did remember his name, after all. A week after the performance, he came home late from work, and when he pulled the rental car into the driveway, he saw his daughter sitting at the dining room table. She was framed photogenically by the room's picture window. For a moment, he felt the vise in his chest tightening. Why was she alone on a Friday night? Why hadn't Dorothy set up a sleepover for her? Why hadn't anyone invited her to their house? But as he climbed out of the car, he saw that she appeared unperturbed and, in fact, rather happy, or at least happily occupied. She had her earbuds in and was making Christmas cards, the supplies spread out in a glittering swath across the table. When she spotted him outside, she immediately yanked out her earbuds, pushed back her chair, and hurled herself against the picture window, landing with a soft thud. Her cheek lay smushed against the glass, her arms were splayed, and while she still needed one leg to stand on, she'd lifted the other and pressed its bent shape to the window. What in the world? He had no idea what she was expressing or rehearsing, but the gesture was undoubtedly directed at him. Out in the darkness, he gave her a thumbs up, but her eyes were limply shut. Not a muscle moved. It was all very realistic. Was he witnessing the magic of dance, of, what was it called when she was little, creative movement? Somehow, she had managed to convey through her body precisely what he'd been feeling since November. Not crushed, not flattened, but flung, as if from an obliterating blast against a hard, exposing surface. Spread, embarrassed, suspended, without the strength to open his eyes and survey the damage. He put down his computer bag and drew closer to the window. He tapped lightly on the pane, but she didn't flinch. Pressing his palm to hers, he wondered if she could feel his outline through the glass. He tried it with his other palm, and then his cheek. He raised and crooked his knee to match the angle of her leg. In 6th grade theater class, he'd had to do mirror games, but actually this was easier, because now he got to choose his partner. What was hard was balancing on one foot. When he started to wobble, her silent laughter made the whole window shake.
That was David Bosmoskis reading Likes by Sarah Swanyan Bynum. The story appeared in The New Yorker in October 2017 and was included in Bynum's collection, Likes, which was published in 2020. Hi, I'm Deborah Treisman, fiction editor of The New Yorker. Each week on the Writer's Voice podcast, New Yorker fiction writers read their newly published stories from the magazine. You can hear from authors like Colson Whitehead.
Turner nudged Elwood, who had a look of horror on his face. They saw it. Griff wasn't going down. He was going to go for it, no matter what happened after.
Poor Joy Williams.
Her father was silent. Slowly, he passed his hand over his hair. This usually meant that he was traveling to a place immune to her presence, a place that indeed contradicted her presence. She might as well go to lunch.
Listen to new stories or dive into our archive of great fiction. You can find the work of your favorite fiction writers and discover new ones. Listen and follow The Writer's Voice wherever you get your podcasts. David, I feel as though in a way this is almost a mystery story, as both this father and the reader try to understand whether what this girl is going through is a so-called normal tween experience or whether there's something more serious or complicated happening with her.
Right.
Do you have an idea about the answer to that question?
Well, you know, having read it multiple times now, I think what's interesting about it is, well, it, to that question specifically, this idea of normal, why the father is so concerned about his daughter. Why does he, like, why is he so involved? Why is it so all-consuming for him at this moment in time? What is it that gives him reason to fear that there's anything really terrible happening? And to me, it feels more like, if it's a mystery, part of it is like what is wrong with him more than what's wrong with her? And in a way, maybe even like, what is wrong with contemporary parenting than with this girl? There are two parents in this story. One of them is much more anxious than the other. Mm-hmm. And maybe in Sarah's choice of choosing to tell it from the dad's perspective, it's the person who's most removed from, you know, not just the experience of being a tween, but also of being a tween girl. I mean, he must have, you know, he knew some, but he was never one of them. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if the reason that Dorothy isn't as freaked out as the dad, whose name we ultimately learn, is in part because she was once a girl.
Right. And also they talk more. I mean, it seems as though what's happened is fairly common, which is this girl has hit the age where she shuts down on her parents, or maybe just on her father, you know, where he had a little girl who probably talked to him all the time, and now she's not talking. Mm-hmm. And that can be devastating for a parent.
Yes. And I guess we catch him in a moment where he, you know, he talks about clues. He's looking for clues, and he's looking for clues in particularly, you know, from her Instagram feed. So yeah, it sounds like, you know, something had changed. There was, you know, a previous Ivy and then a new Ivy, and he's trying to understand.
Yeah. The irony of it is trying to understand through Instagram. You know, what he's looking at is what she's choosing to present as her public persona. It's perhaps kind of aspirational. I mean, how much do you think he can find her real self there?
And yet we do it all the time. in a way, maybe because it's the public persona that she transmits to the world that is not meant to be her parents. She doesn't think about her parents looking at these things. She's thinking about her peers, the people that she wants to get likes from. Mm-hmm. So I guess he feels like, you know, he can't go into the low-slung buildings and follow her into school, but maybe this is the closest he can get to that aspect of tween experience. It's a curated thing that she's putting out there. And ultimately, you know, he gets frustrated. On the one hand, he wants her to be normal, but he also doesn't want her to be cliche, which is interesting.
Right, right. I was reading an interview with Bynum about this story where she said, these photographs offer a window into the daughter's inner world that I think is much more wild and tangled and rich than the medium or the format of Instagram itself might suggest. That made me sort of stop and think, because I'd hit, you know, everything's pink and moved on in a way. But what wildness do you think you see in these photographs that she's put up?
I don't. I hate to dispute the author, but I don't until the seatbelt one, which is something that feels wilder. But I also think maybe she does it because something has changed in her post-election.
Right. We get the all-black post, and then she's back to pink, but it's a pink wound.
It's a pink wound. And she's also, you know, the one image that isn't, you know, on Instagram, but it's in his car, the thing that she used to have above her bed that she, you know, that he doesn't understand how it got in the car, but we do.
Well, let's talk about that. What do you assume she put it there, yeah?
Yeah. Yeah, she doesn't feel like it's a dark moment where it doesn't feel like life is offering you a second chance called tomorrow, because she woke up tomorrow and tomorrow was not good.
What do you think is going on in her mind that makes her stick that sign on her father's dashboard? I mean, obviously she's trying to make a point to him. It doesn't occur to him that that's what she's doing.
It didn't occur to me either. It was funny because I thought that I like your reading of it better. I thought she was just trying to get rid of it. But maybe your reading is the better one, that it's a more hopeful one, that she's actually reassuring him.
Or accusing. I mean, who knows? Oh. Who knows? You know, it could go either way. I just think if she wanted to get rid of it, she would have put it in the garbage can or something. But
right,
it seems so personalized to put it on her father's dashboard.
But she's also unaware of the garbled syntax. And it has, if that's what she meant to do, it definitely doesn't have that effect. It has the opposite effect. It just reinforces his despair.
Yeah, and reminds him of Michigan. I want to go back to something you brought up earlier, the fact that Dorothy and Ivy have names from almost the beginning of the story, but the father, his name doesn't come up until very close to the end. And even then, he's surprised that someone has used it, that the physical therapist remembers it. And I wonder why you think that is, why he goes nameless for so long.
There are two characters in the story that don't have names, him and the person who wins the election. But the physical therapist is also never named. It's a, you know, in thinking about the story, it's the dad, who we later learn is named Dave. He's like the only man in the story, and it's a story otherwise populated by women. And I wanted to have like this great theory where the man is not named, but all the women are. Well, there's also Bob, who's the dog. We assume Bob is a male dog. It's because he doesn't have individuality for most of the story. And I think there's this moment where, I mean, until then, and there's something going on between him and his and this physical therapist, which is quite tame, but slightly more than just tame.
What do you mean? I think he's competitive with the physical therapist.
Well, I also think he's uncomfortable around her in some way, but also because I think he's attracted to her. I think that moment where, you know, he notes, did she bring a boyfriend? Is there somebody with her? It's the only relationship in the story where he's nervous in a way that has to do with himself, like his individual personal self. He wants to, I don't know, impress her in some way. I think in all the other ways he's so neuter, right? Like even with his wife he's so neuter.
Yeah, except for that one moment when he's just, he has so much sort of affection in him to give, so he gives her a hug and like knocks her over onto the bed.
Right.
Topples her.
Right, but he could have been Bob the dog the way he does it, you know what I mean?
Exactly.
It's like, how did these people even copulate to have a child? Like, there's something that happened to Dave. You know, we have an account of him when he's a teenager, you know, playing basketball, and there's something very physical going on with him. Like he plays basketball, he gets hurt, and then most of his existence is channeled into worrying about his daughter, some part of it worrying about the election. But as for like him having any desire or aspirations or anything that is personal in a way. We don't even, like, he goes to work, we don't know what his job is. We don't know what Dorothy's job is either.
Yeah. I mean, I wondered if he's called the father for so long just because that's all he is, and that's all we're going to get of him is him as a father.
And that's why I think when the therapist says she remembered his name, that's why it's such a thrill to him, because mm-hmm. she saw him, you know, even in this kind of trivial way, as more than just the hulking attendant to the patient, right? Yeah. Like, she saw Dave as a man, I don't know.
Or as a person.
Yeah, as a person. Yeah,
a person with a name.
And that kind of affirms him. Like, I don't know how Dave got to be so far gone that this is what he needs, but I think that's what happens. Like, for so much of the story, he is just the dad, and all his energy is channeled into mostly his daughter.
Yeah. And yet it's not a typical generation gap story. It's not about there being friction caused by a parent being unable to understand the experience of a child. You know, it's what seems most sort of salient to me here is the intensity of his desire to understand. You know, he's not yelling at her, you need to be acting in this way and not that way. He's doing the opposite. He's saying, you can say whatever you want and I'll be completely silent and expressionless, you know. This enormous well of feeling for her, and then no way to express it.
No way to express it that he's good at or that they can find. But I think that's probably true of contemporary parenting, including for fathers, where I think the stereotype before was of being sort of a distant, absent person. I mean, yeah, I have three daughters and I have friends who are fathers and they're very involved in their children's lives. You know, the danger is the pendulum swinging too much in the other extreme, where you become too involved and you lose a sense of yourself. So it's like finding the place where you can show love, but also, you know, leave your children the space to be who they need to be.
Yeah.
I think you're more sympathetic to Dave than I am. I feel like Dave has done some of this to himself, not to be too hard on him, but it's like back to sort of this question I pose about him is like, how did you let this happen to yourself? Like,
yeah.
You weren't this way your whole life, but I guess it is one of the bizarre paradoxes of becoming a parent, where, you know, you had been your own person for so long and then you have children and the idea is that they're supposed to learn from you and you're supposed to be some kind of model, to use that word. They're modeling behavior. But at the same time, he's so wrapped up in what's happening with her that I'm not sure what he's modeling, you know?
Yeah.
So in nobody listening to him, it's like, well, I'm not sure what Dave has to say that is worth listening to. Not to be too hard on Dave, but I guess I am.
Yeah, you're kind of unforgiving. He makes some good choices, right? Like when, in that moment when he says, you can say whatever you want and I won't comment on it, he gives her a huge amount of freedom.
Oh, definitely.
He's very attuned to her mood. And I think generally not falsely so. He doesn't seem to be imagining it.
No, I think he's incredibly well-meaning and really does want to understand her. We're starting to get into some sort of like parenting philosophy part of our conversation. But it's like, yeah, well, what do children actually want? What do they want from their parents? Love, the fact that their parents want to understand them. But probably
some independence, yeah.
But something else, like to understand, like to see something of their parents that's admirable. When she comes after the election and says, you know, about going to school, and he's like, just go back to bed. And then she comes back and she thinks he's joking. And she says, Daddy. Oh, it's kind of heartbreaking when she calls him Daddy, because he's the dad. But then she's like the little girl. And he says, no, I meant it. Like, it's that really the one moment in the story where he's not catering to her.
Yeah. She's also probably afraid, right? And she wants her world to be normal. And this is so abnormal. There's sort of a failure of the parental authority. You're right. There is a moment in which he's sort of failing her there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's so interesting to think about this story because we're talking about it 8 years later. There's so much vagueness around the election. The year is never given. The name of the candidates is never given. It's this idea that like 50 years from now, well, you need footnotes to understand what's going on here.
Right. Well, we get the father saying, you know, or he has high hopes that basic decency will prevail.
Right.
Which is a tip off for us right now. Maybe I hope it still will be in the future.
Yes.
But of course, it doesn't prevail.
No, it didn't. It certainly did not feel like decency prevailed. Or yeah. I think, you know, maybe this is worth talking about now. You know, why the story is set at this particular moment, and what is it that, you know, joins what's happening with him and Ivy and the election, like the commonality between these two things?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I think there's a kind of continual sort of threat of danger in the story that keeps almost happening. I mean, and then even the most dangerous moment, that car accident, you know, you get to that passage and you think, oh my God, you know, she's going to die or he's going to die or something. And that's just like a seatbelt burn on Instagram. I mean, you never even know what happened. His attention was distracted from the road because he's obsessing about a YouTuber in this, you know, sarcastic way.
A YouTuber, but also somebody else. Right?
Right.
It's, yeah. He goes from the jargon of YouTube to the jargon of Trump.
Yeah. 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 And then, of course, that is, in the world of the story, the biggest disaster is the election result.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like the story ends on a happy note.
Yes.
Surprisingly. Just with this strange moment of connection between them. But what sets it off is this bizarre image of this, you know, this child throwing herself at the window and, you know, hitting it in the position of someone flung as if from an obliterating blast against a hard exposing surface. It doesn't, you know, this doesn't sound lighthearted. What do you think what should we think she's doing there?
I mean, there's, I think, a literal thing that she's doing, which alludes to, I would say, the car accident, right? The thing that we don't see, mm-hmm. the windshield. I guess she wasn't probably flattened against the windshield because of the seatbelt. But I think she's alluding to that. And then there's this other part of it, which I guess is, for him, it's the election. I don't know if she's alluding to that. It's at the level of storycraft. It's so amazing because, and it took me a while to absorb it. Like the story starts with Dave looking at Instagram, which is just images, you know, under glass.
Mm-hmm.
And it ends with her actually becoming this ephemeral Instagram image just for him and that he can participate in. And he gives her a thumbs up in the dark. Like it's so subtle, right? But for those of us who know, who've, you know, which is I think everybody now, like how do you demonstrate that you like something? Well, yeah, it's a thumbs up, it's a like. So he likes her image to the point of what you were saying, Deborah, about how the images become wilder. I think that's the wildest one of them all. And that one is just for him. And he likes it. He likes it so much. He, you know, communes with it in his way.
I have mixed responses to it because I also, the description of it makes me think of kind of a chalk outline, you know, where the body has fallen. That kind of pose that you would see in a death scene.
Yes.
And then he makes it alive again.
And he's also balancing on one foot, and she's balancing on one foot. And there's, you know, all that stuff about, you know, his bad leg and her bad leg. Yeah, it just, it ties so much together at the very end. And then she, you know, and then she laughs. I don't think she's really laughed with him or for him.
Yeah.
Up to this point. And it's so loving. You know, finally he gets the Instagram image that he wanted. So, I mean, in that sense, it's a very hopeful ending. And he also concedes that it's something that probably could not have been communicated any other way. And so it's an image that he interprets that gives him a sense of connection to her.
Bynum did a Q&A about the story when it came out, and she said, you know, well, I'll just read it to you. She said, "What takes the dad by surprise is not his daughter's ups and downs, but the intensity of his own feelings as he watches her go through them. He thought he was just tagging along for the ride and now finds he can't get off the roller coaster. He knows that he should be down on the ground, waving and smiling in a stationary figure, feet planted. But instead, he's up in the air right beside her, clutching the lap bar and screaming."
And my question is, like, why? You know, why is it so difficult? Why is it so hard for him to create the necessary objective distance in a way that his wife can and he can't? And I guess that's part of the experience of reading the story. It's like, or for me, because I'm a father and, you know, I think about how to parent children, daughters in my case, and do think about, you know, the losing yourself or not losing yourself and, yeah, finding the necessary or the best way to relate to your own children and what, you know, for lack of a better word, what image to present to them.
Yeah. Yeah. He has no Instagram.
No.
Yeah. And he tries several approaches. And that final one's the only one that works.
Yeah.
And I guess it's also, maybe for him, it is kind of a regression to his own 12-year-old self in that, you know, in that flashback, what he thinks of his childhood. I think it's sort of so poignant that he looks at her and thinks she was the kind of girl he would have been afraid of back then, who would have intimidated him. Because she still intimidates him.
Yes. And I think that I've thought that too in reading the story. It's like how odd it is that you can be the parent of someone who would have intimidated you when you were, you know, that age. But I created you. And maybe that's part of Dave's problem, that he's still, even though he says he can't remember himself at, you know, in the sixth grade at 12, so much of the story, when he does reflect back, is about him being her age.
Yeah, and it's funny that what he remembers, you know, he can't remember sixth grade, but he remembers the faces of all the kids in his grade, and they sort of pop up like mugshots. I mean, it sounds to me more like he's remembering a yearbook or something, but that was his Instagram.
Right, exactly. And all of their names, I mean, from a writing standpoint, it's like I would want to ask Sarah, like, are those actually the names of the people in your homeroom, or did you have to like sit down and come up with names, which I find always very, very difficult to do?
I don't think we would have allowed her to use real people's
names. Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. From a legal standpoint, what if she said this kid was awful in sixth grade and then that person sued us?
But she didn't say anything about them. They just their just their names and their faces.
Yeah. So, yeah, no, I think those were invented Dave classmates.
Oh, that's hard to do. We didn't talk about the title at all. Should we talk about the title?
Yeah, let's talk about the title. So I mean, there's the obvious reason that it's called Likes. Do you think there are less obvious reasons?
It really gets at the core of Dave's concern about language and probably, you know, the author's concern about language too. And the extent to which it enables something in our lives and in the culture when language gets transformed this way, you know, in the most, like kind of in an anxious way to talk about it.
Yeah. But for Ivy, that is her language. That's the language she's learned and knows, and she wouldn't question it.
Exactly. Yeah, that's good. That's good that you say that, Deborah, because I say the first part where it's like I sound like old and boomerish, and then you say this part, which is good. Yes. Yeah. And it's not as menacing to her.
It's just a fact of life, right? This is what she's young enough, you know, for there not to be really a pre-social media time in her life. There's a time when she probably didn't have it, but there wasn't a time when it didn't exist.
And I think the way that she knows that there's anything even, you know, somewhat pejorative associated with it is her parents and her dad. And she tweaks him. She plays with him about, like, she's writing a YA novel. Come on, Dad, it's reading. She knows how he feels, but he seems ridiculous to her in that way, I think, in the way that all parents seem ridiculous to their children when they feel kind of outmoded.
Yeah. So for you and me, it's like, I'm sure, well, at least I have got to that point where I'm like, yes, it's reading. It's reading. Read it. Do it. Yeah. Do it. Because at least you're reading, as opposed to staring at your phone. So
yes,
she knows I'm there in that moment.
I got dragged along. I'm there too. Yeah, she knows. She knows. They're both right, which is what's great about, you know, good art. They're both right. I think he's right to be anxious, and she's also right to not be paranoid, and just to live her life. And there's probably, as he's trying to reflect back on being, you know, 12 years old, and is it normal? Well, yeah, if he could access that part of himself, you could take all the Instagram out of it and the Snapchat, because that's not really what he's worried about. He's worried about what it's like to be 12 and that it hasn't changed quite so much, if only he could access it. The nice thing is to be reminded that, you know, even in your most paranoid moments, that there's still more that is similar than dissimilar about, you know, being a child.
Yeah, yeah. And ultimately, he's worried about her happiness. You know, he's worried about what she's feeling.
Yeah. And I guess parents have always worried about that. I'm actually not 100% sure that parents have always worried about it to this extent.
Yeah, no, I'm not sure either.
It's the type of preoccupation that feels.
You're supposed to be feeling. Yeah. You're supposed to be doing your homework.
Yeah. And you as a parent are supposed to be, like, you know, off, you know, smoking or something.
The cocktail party.
Yeah. But he's concerned about, you know, did Dorothy set up a play date? But it's so beautifully done because it's prismatic in that way. You can see it from all these sides. And it's funny. So many instances where I had to, like, try not to crack up because the writing is so good. And she does this thing, which she does it in her other stories too, a type of withholding, like with the fork. You only realize later that in his rant, he'd, like, smack the fork off the table. And it's this very satisfying way of figuring that out. And the same way with the car accident and all these things. This lovely sort of dramatic withholding.
Yeah, yeah. Well, thank you, David.
Oh, so much fun. It's such a great story.
Sarah Swenyan Bynum is the author of three books of fiction, Madeline is Sleeping, a winner of the Janet Heidinger Kafka Prize, Miss Hempel Chronicles, and Likes, which was published in 2020 and was a finalist for the LA Times Book Prize and the Story Prize. In 2010, she was chosen as one of the New Yorker's 20 under 40 fiction writers. David Bismoskis is a filmmaker and writer. He's published two story collections and two novels, The Free World, which was a finalist for the Governor General's Award and the Giller Prize, and The Betrayers, which won the National Jewish Book Award. He was also chosen as one of the New Yorker's 20 under 40 in 2010. You can download more than 200 previous episodes of the New Yorker Fiction Podcast or subscribe to the podcast for free in Apple Podcasts. On the Writer's Voice podcast, you can hear short stories from the magazine read by their authors. You can find the Writer's Voice and other New Yorker podcasts on your podcast app. Tell us what you thought of this program on our Facebook page or rate and review us in Apple Podcasts. This episode of the New Yorker Fiction Podcast was produced by Jill Duboff. I'm Deborah Treisman. Thanks for listening.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.